best be careful, and don't let anyone see it. You know what they think of this kind of book.
Bai got up, looked around carefully once again, and left. More than 4 decades later, in her last moments, Ya Wenxia would recall the influence Silent Spring had on her life. The book dealt only with a limited subject, the negative environmental effects of excessive pesticide use, but the perspective taken by the author shook Ya to the core. The use of pesticides had seemed to Ya just a normal, proper, or at least neutral act. But Carson's book allowed Ye to see that from nature's perspective, their use was indistinguishable from the Cultural Revolution, and equally destructive to our world. If this was so, then how many other acts of humankind that had seemed normal or even righteous were, in reality, evil? As she continued to mull over these thoughts, a deduction made her shudder. Is it possible that the relationship between humanity and evil is similar to the relationship between the ocean and an iceberg floating on its surface? Both the ocean and the iceberg are made of the same material. That the iceberg seems separate is only because it is in a different form. In reality, it is but a part of the vast ocean. It was impossible to expect a moral awakening from humankind itself, just like it was impossible to expect humans to lift off the earth by pulling up on their own hair. To achieve moral awakening required a force outside the human race. This thought determined the entire direction of Ya's life. 4 days after receiving the book, Ya went to the company's guest house, where Bai was living, to return the book. Ya opened the door and saw that Bai was lying on the bed, exhausted and covered by wood shavings and mud. When Bai saw Ye, he struggled to get up.
"Did you work today?"
Ye asked.
"I've been here with the company for so long, I can't just walk around all day doing nothing. Have to participate in labor. That's the spirit of the revolution, right? Oh, I worked near Radar Peak. The trees there were so dense. I sank into the rotting leaves all the way up to my knees. I'm afraid I'll get sick from the miasma."
"Radar Peak?"
Yeah, was shocked.
"Yes. The regiment had an emergency assignment. Clear out a warning zone all around the peak by cutting down trees."
Radar Peak was a mysterious place. The steep, once nameless peak got its moniker from the large parabolic antenna dish at the top. In reality, everyone with a little common sense knew it wasn't a radar antenna. Even though its orientation changed every day, the antenna never moved in a continuous manner. As the wind blew past it, the dish emitted a howl that could be heard from far away. People in Ya's company knew only that Radar Peak was a military base. According to the locals, when the base was built 3 years ago, the military mobilized a lot of people to construct a road leading to the top and a string of power line along it. Tons of supplies were transported up the mountain. But after the completion of the base, the road was destroyed, leaving behind only a difficult trail that snaked between the trees. Often helicopters could be seen landing on and lifting off the peak. The antenna wasn't always visible. When the wind was too strong, it was retracted. But when it was extended, many strange things occurred around the area. Animals in the forest became noisy and anxious. Flocks of birds erupted from the woods, and people suffered nausea and dizziness. Also, those who lived near Radar Peak tended to lose their hair. According to the locals, these phenomena only began after the antenna was built. There were many strange stories associated with Radar Peak. One time, when it was snowing, the antenna was extended, and the snow instantly turned to rain. Since the temperature near ground was still below freezing, the rain turned to ice on the trees. Gigantic icicles hung from the trees, and the forest turned into a crystal palace. From time to time, branches cracked under the weight of the ice, and the icicles crashed to the ground with loud thumps. Sometimes, when the antenna was extended, a clear day would turn to thunder and lightning, and strange lights would appear in the night sky. After the arrival of the Construction Corps Company, the commander told everyone right away to take care to avoid approaching the heavily guarded radar peak, because the patrols were allowed to shoot without warning. Last week, two of the men had gone hunting and chased a deer to the foot of Radar Peak without realizing where they were, and the sentries stationed halfway up the peak shot at them. Luckily, the forest was so dense that the two escaped without injury, though one of the men peed in his pants. At the company meeting the next day, both men were reprimanded. Maybe it was because of this incident that the base had directed the Corps to create a warning zone in the forest around the peak. The fact that the base could issue labor assignments to the Construction Corps hinted at its political power. Bai Moulin accepted the book from Ye and carefully hid it under his pillow. From the same place, he retrieved a few sheets of paper filled with dense writing and handed them to her.
"This is a draft of my letter. Would you read it?" "Letter?" "Like I was telling you, I want to write to the central leadership in Beijing."
The handwriting was very sloppy, and Ye had to read it slowly, but the content was informative and tightly argued. The letter began by describing how the Taihong Mountains had turned from a historically fertile place to the barren wasteland it was today as a result of deforestation. It then described the recent rapid rise in the Yellow River's silt content. Finally, it concluded that the Inner Mongolia Production and Construction Corps' actions would lead to severe ecological consequences. Ye noticed that Bai's style was similar to that of Silent Spring, precise and plain, but also poetic. Though her background was in technical subjects, she enjoyed the literary prose.
"It's beautiful," she said sincerely.
Bai nodded.
"Then I'll send it."
He took out a few fresh sheets of paper to make a clean copy of the draft, but his hands shook so much that he couldn't form any characters. This was a common reaction after using a chainsaw for the first time. Their trembling hands couldn't even hold a rice bowl steady, let alone write legibly.
"Why don't I copy it for you?"
Ye said. She took the pen from him.
"You have such pretty handwriting,"
Bai said as he looked at her first line of characters on the page. He poured a glass of water for Ye. His hand shook so much that he spilled some of the water. Ye moved the letter out of the way.
"You studied physics?"
Bai asked.
"Astrophysics. Useless now."
Ye did not even lift her head.
"You study the stars. How can that be useless? Colleges have reopened recently, but they're not taking graduate students. For highly educated and skilled individuals like you to be sent to a place like this."
Ye said nothing and kept on writing. She did not want to tell Bai that for someone like her to be able to join the Construction Corps was very fortunate. She didn't want to comment on the way things were. There was nothing worthwhile to say. The hut became quiet, filled only with the sound of pen nibs scratching against paper. Ye could smell the fragrance of the sawdust on Bai's body. For the first time since the death of her father, she experienced warmth in her heart and allowed herself to relax, momentarily letting down her guard against the world. More than an hour later, she was done copying the letter. She wrote out the address on the envelope as Bai dictated it and got up to say goodbye. At the door, she turned around.
"Let me have your jacket. I'll wash it for you."
She was surprised by her own boldness.
"No, how can I do that?"
Bai shook his head.
"The women warriors of the Construction Corps work just as hard as the men every day. You should get back to have some rest. Tomorrow you have to get up at 6 to work in the mountains." "Oh, Wincia, I'll be heading back to division headquarters the day after tomorrow. I will explain your situation to my superiors. Maybe it will help." "Thank you. But I like it here. It's quiet."
Ye looked at the dim outline of the dark woods in the moonlight.
"Are you trying to run away from something?" "I'm leaving,"
Ye said in a soft voice, and she did. Bai watched her slender figure disappear in the moonlight. Then he lifted his gaze to the dark woods that she had been looking at a moment earlier. In the distance, the gigantic antenna on top of Radar Peak rose once again, giving off a cold, metallic glint. One afternoon, 3 weeks later, Yaa Wen-Siah was summoned back to company headquarters from the logging camp. As soon as she entered the office, she sensed the mood was wrong. The company commander and the political instructor were both present, along with a stranger with a stern expression. On the desk in front of the stranger was a black briefcase, and an envelope and a book lay next to it. The envelope was open, and the book was the copy of Silent Spring that she had read. During those years, everyone had a special sensitivity for their own political situation. The sense was especially acute in Yaa Wen-Siah. She felt the world around her closing in like a sack being drawn shut, and everything pressing in on her.
Yaa Wen-Siah, this is Director Tsang of the Division Political Department. He's here to investigate.
Her political instructor pointed at the stranger.
We hope you will cooperate fully and tell the truth.
Did you write this letter?
Director Tsang asked. He pulled the letter out of the envelope. Yaa reached for it, but Tsang held on to the letter and showed it to her page by page until he reached the very last page, the one she was most interested in. There was no signature except the revolutionary masses.
No, I did not write this.
Yaa shook her head in fright.
But this is your handwriting.
Yes, but I just copied it for someone else.
Who?
Normally, whenever she suffered some injustice at the company, Yaa refused to protest openly. She simply endured silently and would never consider implicating others. But this time was different. She understood very well what this meant.
I helped a reporter from the Great Production News. He was here a few weeks ago. His name is
Yaa Wen-Siah.
Director Tsang's two black eyes were trained on her like the barrels of two guns.
I am warning you. Framing others will only make your problem worse. We've already clarified the situation with Comrade Bai Mulin. His only involvement was posting the letter from Ho Hot under your direction. He had no idea as to the letter's contents.
He said that?
Yaa felt everything go black before her eyes. Instead of answering, Director Tsang picked up the book.
Your letter was clearly inspired by this book.
He showed the book to the company director and the political instructor.
Silent Spring was published in America in 1962 and has been quite influential in the capitalist world.
He then took another book out of the briefcase. The cover was white with black characters.
This is the Chinese translation. The appropriate authorities distributed it to select cadres as internal reference so that it could be criticized. As of now, the appropriate authorities have already given their clear judgment. The book is a toxic piece of reactionary propaganda. It takes the stance of pure historical idealism and espouses a doomsday theory. Under the guise of discussing environmental problems, it seeks to justify the ultimate corruption of the capitalist world. The content is extremely reactionary.
But this book, it doesn't belong to me.
Comrade Bai was appointed as a translator by the appropriate authorities, so it was perfectly legitimate for him to carry it. Of course, he is responsible for being careless and allowing you to steal it while he was participating in Construction Corps work assignments. From this book, you obtained intellectual weapons that could be used to attack socialism.
Yaa Wen-Siah held her tongue. She knew that she had already fallen to the bottom of the pit. Any struggle was useless. Contrary to certain historical records that later became publicized, Bai Mulin did not intend to frame Yaa Wen-Siah at the start. The letter he wrote to the central leadership in Beijing was likely based on a real sense of responsibility. Back then, many people wrote to the central leadership with all kinds of personal agendas. Most of these letters were never answered, But a few of the letter writers did see their political fortunes rise meteorically overnight, while others invited catastrophe. The political currents of the time were extremely complex. As a reporter, Bai believed he could read the currents and avoid dangerous sensitivities, but he was overconfident, and his letter touched a minefield that he did not know existed. After he heard about its reception, fear overwhelmed everything else. In order to protect himself, he decided to sacrifice Ye Wenqia. Half a century later, historians would all agree that this event in 1969 was a turning point in humankind's history. Without intending to, Bai became a key historical figure. But he never learned of this fact. Historians recorded the rest of his uneventful life with disappointment. He continued to work at Great Production News until 1975, when the Inner Mongolia Production and Construction Corps was disbanded. He was then sent to a city in northeast China to work for the Science Association until the beginning of the 80s. Then he left the country for Canada, where he taught at a Chinese school in Ottawa until 1991, when he died from lung cancer. For the rest of his life, he never mentioned Ye Wenqia. We do not know if he ever felt remorse or repented for his actions.
Wenxia, the company has treated you extremely well.
The company commander exhaled a thick cloud of smoke from his mohi tobacco. He stared at the ground and continued.
By birth and family background, you're politically suspect. But we've always treated you as one of our own. Both the political instructor and I have spoken to you many times concerning your tendency to sequester yourself from the people and your lack of self-motivation in seeking progress. We want to help you. But look at you. You've committed such a serious error.
The political instructor picked up the theme.
I've always said that I thought she had a deep-rooted resentment of the Cultural Revolution.
Have her escorted to division headquarters this afternoon, along with the evidence of her crime.
Director Zhang said, his face impassive. The three other women prisoners in the cell were taken away one by one, until only Ye was left. The small pile of coal in the corner had been exhausted, and no one came to replenish it. The fire in the stove had gone out a while ago. It was so cold in the cell that Ye had to wrap herself in the blanket. Two officials came to her before it got dark. The older one, a female cadre, was introduced by her associate as the military representative from the Intermediate People's Court.
My name is Cheng Lihua.
The cadre introduced herself. She was in her 40s, dressed in a military coat, and wore thick-rimmed glasses. Her face was gentle, and it was clear that she'd been very beautiful when she was young. She spoke with a smile, and instantly made people like her. Ye Wenxia understood that it was unusual for such a high-grade cadre to visit a prisoner about to be tried. Cautiously, she nodded at Chang and moved to make space on her narrow cot so she could sit down.
It's really cold in here. What happened to your stove?
Chang gave a reprimanding look to the head of the detention center standing at the door of the cell. She turned back to Ye.
You're very young, even younger than I imagined.
She sat down on the cot right next to Ye and rummaged in her briefcase, still muttering.
Wenxia, you're very confused. Young people are all the same. The more books you read, the more confused you become. What can I say?
She found what she was looking for and took out a small bundle of papers. Looking at Ye, her eyes were filled with kindness and affection.
But it's not a big deal. What young person hasn't made some mistakes? I made mistakes myself. When I was a young woman, as a member of the art troupe for the 4th Field Army, I specialized in singing Soviet songs. One time, during a political study session, I announced that China should cease to be a separate country and join the USSR as a member republic. That way, international communism would be further strengthened. how naive I was. But who wasn't once naive? What's done is done. When you make a mistake, what's important is to recognize it and correct it. Then you can continue the revolution.
Chang's words seemed to draw Ye closer to her. But after having gone through so many troubles, Ye had learned to be cautious. She did not dare to believe in this kindness, which almost resembled a luxury. Chang placed the stack of papers on the bed in front of Ye and handed her a pen.
Come now, sign this. Then we can have a good heart-to-heart and resolve your ideological difficulties.
Her tone was like that of a mother trying to encourage her daughter to eat. Ye stared at the stack of papers silently and motionlessly. She did not pick up the pen. Chang gave her a forgiving smile.
You can trust me, Wentia. I personally guarantee that this document has nothing to do with your case. Go ahead, sign it.
Her associate, who stood to the side, added,
Ya Wentia, Representative Chang is trying to help you. She's been working hard on your behalf.
Chang waved at him to stop.
It's understandable. Poor child, you've been so frightened. There are some comrades whose political awareness is not adequately high. Some members of the Construction Corps and some of the folks from the People's Court employ such simplistic methods and behave so rudely. It's completely inappropriate. All right, Wenxia. Why don't you read the document? Read it carefully.
Ye picked up the document and flipped through it in the dim yellow light of the detention cell. Representative Chang hadn't lied to her. The document really had nothing to do with her case. It was about her father. In it was a record of her father's interactions and conversations with certain individuals. The source was Wenxia's younger sister, Wen Xue. As one of the most radical Red Guards, Wen Xue had always been proactive in exposing their father, and had composed numerous reports detailing his supposed sins. Some of the material she provided had ultimately led to his death. But Ye could tell that this report didn't come from the hand of her sister. Wen Xue had an intense, impatient style. When you read her reports, each line would make an explosive impact, like a string of firecrackers. But this document was composed in a cool, experienced, meticulous style. Who spoke to whom? When? Where? What was discussed? Every detail was recorded, down to the exact date. For someone who wasn't experienced, the contents seemed like a boring diary, but the calculating, cold purpose hidden within was very different from the childish antics of Wen Xue. Ye couldn't really understand what the document was getting at, but she could sense that it had something to do with an important national defense project. As the daughter of a physicist, Ye guessed that it was a reference to the double bomb project that had shocked the world in 1964 and 1967. During this period of the Cultural Revolution, in order to bring down a highly positioned individual, it was necessary to gather evidence of his deficiencies in the various areas he was in charge of. But for those plotting such political machinations, the double bomb project posed great difficulties. People in the highest levels of the government placed the project under their protection to avoid disruption by the Cultural Revolution. It was difficult for those with nefarious purposes to pry into its inner workings. Due to her father's family background, he couldn't meet the political requirements and did not work on the double bomb project. All he had done was some peripheral theoretical work for it. But it was easier to make use of him than those who had worked at the core of the project. Yet Wenxia couldn't tell if the contents of the document were true or false, but she was sure that every character and every punctuation mark had the potential to deliver a fatal political blow. In addition to those targeted directly, countless others might have their fates altered because of this document. At the end of the document was her sister's signature in large characters, and Ye Wenxia was supposed to sign as a witness. She noticed that three other witnesses had already signed.
I don't know anything about these conversations,
Ye said softly. She put the document back down.
How can you not know? Many of these conversations occurred right in your home. Your sister knew them. You must too. I really don't. But these conversations really did occur. You must have faith in us. I didn't say they weren't true, but I really don't know about them, so I can't sign.
Yeah, Wincia? Chang's associate took a step closer, but Chang stopped him again. She shifted to sit even closer to Ye and picked up one of her cold hands.
Wincia, let me put all my cards on the table. Your case has a lot of prosecutorial discretion. On the one hand, we could minimize it as a case of an educated youth being fooled by a reactionary book. It's not a big deal. We don't even need to go through a judicial procedure. We'll have you attend a political class and write a few self-criticism reports, and then you can go back to the construction corps. On the other hand, we could also prosecute this case to its fullest extent. Wencia, you must know that you could be declared an active counter-revolutionary. Now, faced with political cases like yours, all prosecutorial organs and courts would rather be too severe than too lax. This is because treating you too severely would just be a mistaken method, but treating you too laxly would be a mistaken political direction. Ultimately, however, the decision belongs to the Military Control Commission. Of course, I'm telling you all this off the record.
Chang's associate added, Representative Chang is trying to save you. Three witnesses have already signed. Your refusal to sign is pretty much meaningless. I must urge you not to be confused, Ye Wincia.
Right, Wincia,
Chang continued.
It would break my heart to see an educated young person like you ruined by something like this. I really want to save you. Please cooperate. Look at me. Do you think I would hurt you?
But Ye did not look at Representative Chang. What she saw instead was her father's blood.
Representative Chang, I have no knowledge of the events recorded in this document. I cannot sign it.
Chang Lihua became quiet. She stared at Ye for a long while, and the cold air in the cell seemed to solidify. Then she slowly put the document back into her briefcase and stood up. Her kind expression did not disappear, but was set on her face like a plaster mask. Still appearing kind and affectionate, she walked to the corner of the cell where there was a bucket for washing. She picked it up and poured half the water onto Ye, and the other half onto her blanket, her movements never straying from a methodical calmness. Then she dropped the bucket and left the cell, pausing only to mutter,
"You stubborn little bitch."
The head of the detention center was the last to leave. He stared coldly at Ye, soaked through and dripping, shut the cell door with a bang, and locked it. Through her wet clothes, the chill of the Inner Mongolian winter seized Ye like a giant's fist. She heard her teeth chatter, but eventually even that sound disappeared. The coldness penetrated into her bones, and the world in her eyes turned milky white. She felt that the entire universe was a huge block of ice, and she was the only spark of life within it. She was the little girl about to freeze to death, and she didn't even have a handful of matches, only illusions. The block of ice holding her gradually became transparent. In front of her, she could see a tall building. At the top, a young girl waved a bright red banner. Her slender figure contrasted vividly with the breadth of the flag. It was her sister, Wan Shua. Ever since her little sister had made a clean break with her reactionary academic authority family, when Sia had heard no news about her, she had only learned recently that Wen Shua had died 2 years ago in one of the wars between Red Guard factions. As Ye watched, the figure waving the flag became Bai Mulin, his glasses reflecting the flames raging below the building. Then it turned into Representative Chang, then her mother, Shao Lin, then her father.
The flag bearer kept on changing, but the flag waved ceaselessly, like a perpetual pendulum, counting down the remainder of her short life. Gradually, the flag grew blurry. Everything grew blurry. The ice that filled the universe once again sealed her at its center. Only this time, the ice was black. 3. Red Coast 1. Ye Winxia heard a loud, continuous roar. She didn't know how much time had passed. The noise came from all around her. In her vague state of consciousness, it seemed as though some gigantic machine was drilling into or sawing through the block of ice that held her. The world was still only darkness, but the noise grew more and more real. Finally, she was certain that the source of the noise was neither heaven nor hell, and she remained in the land of the living. She realized that her eyes were still closed. With an effort, she lifted her eyelids. The first thing she saw was a light embedded deeply in the ceiling. Covered by a wire mesh that seemed designed to protect it, it emitted a dim glow. The ceiling appeared to be made of metal. She heard a male voice softly calling her name.
"You have a high fever,"
the man said.
"Where am I?"
Wensia's voice was so weak that she couldn't be sure it was her own.
"On a helicopter."
Yeah, felt weak. She fell back to sleep. As she dozed, the roar kept her company. Before long, she woke again. Now the numbness had disappeared, and the pain reasserted itself. Her head and the joints of her limbs ached, and the breath coming out of her mouth felt scalding hot. Her throat hurt so much that swallowing spittle felt like it was a piece of burning coal. She turned her head and saw two men wearing the same kind of military coat that Representative Chang had worn. But unlike her, both of these men had on the cotton cap of the PLA, a red star sewn onto the front. Their coats were unbuttoned, and she could see the red collar insignia on their army uniforms. One of the men wore glasses. Ye discovered that she was covered by a military coat as well. The clothes she was wearing were dry and warm. She struggled to sit up, and to her surprise, succeeded. She looked out the porthole on the other side. Rolling clouds slowly drifted by, reflecting the dazzling sunlight. She pulled her gaze back. The narrow cabin was filled with iron trunks painted military green. From another porthole, she could see flickering shadows cast by the rotors. She was indeed on a helicopter.
"You'd better lie back down,"
the man with the glasses said. He helped her down and covered her with the coat again.
"Yeah, Winxia, did you write this paper?"
The other man extended an open English journal before her eyes. The title of the paper was The Possible Existence of Phase Boundaries Within the Solar Radiation Zone and Their Reflective Characteristics. He showed her the cover of the journal, an issue of the Journal of Astrophysics from 1966.
"Of course she did. Why does that even need to be confirmed?"
The man wearing glasses took the journal away and then made introductions.
"This is Political Commissar Lei Tu Cheng of Red Coast Base. I'm Yang Weining, Base Chief Engineer. It'll be an hour before we land. You might as well get some rest." "You're Yang Weining?"
Yeah, didn't say anything, but she was stunned. She saw that he kept his expression calm, apparently not wishing to let anyone else know that they knew each other. Yang had been one of Ye Zitai's graduate students. By the time he had obtained his degree, Wenxia was still a first year in college. She could clearly remember the first time Yang came to her home. He had just begun his graduate studies and needed to discuss the direction of his research with Professor Ye. Yang said that he wanted to focus on experimental and applied problems, staying away from theory. Yet Wenxia recalled her father saying,
"I'm not opposed to your idea. But we are, after all, the Department of Theoretical Physics. Why do you want to avoid theory?"
Yang replied,
"I want to devote myself to the times, to make some real-world contributions."
Her father said, "Theory is the foundation of application. Isn't discovering fundamental laws the biggest contribution to our time? Young hesitated and finally revealed his real concern.
It's easy to make ideological mistakes in theory.
Her father had nothing to say to that. Young was very talented, with a good mathematical foundation and a quick mind. But during his brief time as a graduate student, he always kept a respectable distance from his thesis advisor. Yeah, Wintia had seen Young several times, but perhaps due to the influence of her father, she hadn't noticed him much. As for whether he had paid much attention to her, she had no idea. After Young got his degree, he soon ceased all contact with her father. Again feeling weak, Ye closed her eyes. The two men left her and crouched behind a row of trunks to converse in lowered voices. But the cabin was so cramped that Ye could hear them even over the roar of the engine.
I still think this isn't a good idea,
Commissar Lei said.
Can you find the personnel I need through normal channels?
Young asked.
I've done all I can. There's no one in the military with this specialization, and going outside the army raises many questions. You know very well that the security clearance needed for this project requires someone willing to join the army. But the bigger issue is the requirement in the security regulations that they be sequestered at the base for extended periods. What's to be done if they have families? Sequester them at the base, too? No one would agree to that. I did find two possible candidates, but both would rather stay at the May 7th cadre schools rather than come here. Of course, we could forcefully move them, but given the nature of this work, we can't have someone who doesn't want to be here.
Then there's no choice but to use her.
But it's so unconventional.
This entire project is unconventional. If something goes wrong, I'll accept the responsibility.
Chief Young, do you really think you can take responsibility for this? You're a technical person, but Red Coast is not like other national defense projects. Its complexity goes far beyond the technical issues.
You're right. But I only know how to solve the technical issues.
By the time they landed, it was dusk. Ye refused to be helped by Young and Lei, and struggled out of the helicopter by herself. A strong gust of wind almost blew her over. The still gyrating rotors sliced through the wind, making a loud whistling noise. The scent of the woods on the wind was familiar to her, and she was familiar to the wind. It was the wind of the greater Khingan Mountains. She soon heard another sound, a kind of low, forceful bass howl that seemed to form the background of the world, the parabolic antenna dish in the wind. Only now, when she was so close to it, did she finally feel its immensity. Ye's life had made a big circle this month. She was now on top of Radar Peak. She couldn't help but look in the direction of her construction corps company, but all she could see was a misty sea of trees in the twilight. The helicopter was carrying more than just Ye. Several soldiers came over and began to unload military green cargo trunks from the cabin. They walked by without glancing at her. As she followed Young and Lei, Ye noticed that the top of Radar Peak was spacious. A cluster of white buildings, like delicate toy blocks, nestled under the giant antenna. The trio headed toward the base gate, flanked by two guards, and stopped in front of it. Lei turned to her and spoke solemnly.
Yeah, Wintia, the evidence of your counter-revolutionary crime is incontrovertible, and the court would have punished you as you deserve. But now you have an opportunity to redeem yourself through hard work. You can accept it or refuse it.
He pointed at the antenna.
This is a defense research facility. The research conducted here needs your specialized scientific knowledge. Chief Engineer Young can give you the details, which you should consider carefully.
He nodded at Young, and then entered the gate after the soldiers carrying the trunks. Young waited until the others were gone, and indicated that Ye should follow him a little distance away from the gate, clearly trying to avoid the sentries listening in. He no longer pretended that he didn't know her.
Wintia, Let me be clear. This is not some great opportunity. I learned from the Military Control Commission at the court that although Chang Lihua advocates sentencing you severely, the most that you'll get is 10 years. Considering mitigating circumstances, you'll serve maybe 6 or 7 years. But here...
He nodded in the direction of the base.
...is a research project under the highest security classification. Given your status, if you enter the gate, it's possible...
He paused, as though wanting to let the bass howl of the antenna add to the weight of his words.
You'll never leave for the rest of your life. I want to go in.
Young was surprised by her quick answer.
Don't be hasty. Get back onto the helicopter. It'll take off in 3 hours, and if you refuse our offer, it will take you back.
I don't want to go back. Let's go in.
Ye's voice remained soft, but there was a determination in her tone that was harder than steel. Other than the undiscovered country beyond death, from which no one has ever returned, the place she wanted to be the most was this peak, separated from the rest of the world. Here, she felt a sense of security that had long eluded her.
You should be cautious. Think through what this decision means.
I can stay here for the rest of my life.
Young lowered his head and said nothing. He stared into the distance, as though forcing Ye to sort through her thoughts. Ye stayed silent as well. She pulled her coat tightly around herself and gazed into the distance. There, the greater Qing'an Mountains were fading into the darkening night. It was impossible to stay out here much longer in the cold. Yang began to walk toward the gate. He moved fast, as though trying to leave Ye behind. But Ye stayed close. After they entered the gate of Red Coast Base, the two sentries shut the heavy iron doors. A little ways on, Young stopped and pointed at the antenna.
This is a large-scale weapons research project. If it succeeds, the result will be even more important than the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb.
They came to the largest building in the base, and Young pushed the door open. Ye saw the words Transmission Main Control Room over the door. Inside, warm air tinged with the smell of engine oil enveloped her. She saw that the spacious room was filled with all kinds of instruments and equipment. Signal lights and oscilloscope displays flickered together. A dozen or so operators dressed in military uniform were almost entombed by the rows of instruments, as though they were crouching inside battlefield trenches. The unceasing stream of operational orders and responses gave the whole scene a tense, confusing feel.
It's warmer in here,
Yang said.
Wait here a bit. I'll take care of your living arrangements and return for you.
He pointed at a chair and desk next to the door. Ye saw that someone was already sitting at the desk, a guard carrying a handgun.
I'd rather wait outside,
Ye said. Young smiled at her kindly.
From now on, you'll be a member of the base staff. Other than a few sensitive areas, you can go anywhere you want.
His face suddenly looked uncomfortable as he realized another layer of meaning to his words. You can never leave here again.
I prefer to wait outside.
Ye insisted.
All right.
Young glanced at the guard at the desk, who paid no attention to them. He seemed to understand Ye's concern and brought her back out of the main control room.
Stand somewhere out of the wind, and I'll be back in a few minutes. I just need to get someone to start a fire in your room. Conditions at the base are a bit rough, and we have no heating system.
Ye stood next to the main control room door. The huge antenna was directly behind her, and it blotted out half the sky. From here, she could clearly hear the sounds inside the main control room. Suddenly, the chaotic orders and responses ceased, and the room became completely quiet. All she could hear was the occasional low buzzing noise from some instrument. Then a loud male voice broke the silence.
The People's Liberation Army 2nd Artillery Corps, Red Coast Project, 147th Transmission. Authorization confirmed. Begin 30-second countdown.
Target classification A3, coordinate serial number BN20197F. Position checked and confirmed, 25 seconds.
Transition file number 22. Additions none. Continuations none. Transmission file final check completed. 20 seconds. Energy unit reporting all systems go.
Coding unit reporting all systems go.
Amplifier unit reporting all systems go.
Interference monitoring unit reporting within acceptable range.
We have reached the point of no return. 15 seconds.
Everything became quiet again. 15 seconds later, as a klaxon started to blare, a red light on top of the antenna began to blink rapidly.
Begin transmission. All units continue to monitor.
Yeah felt a light itch on her face. She knew that an enormous electric field had appeared. She lifted her face and gazed in the direction the antenna was pointing, and saw a cloud in the night sky glow with a dim blue light, so dim that at first she thought it was an illusion. But as the cloud drifted away, the glow disappeared. Another cloud that drifted into position began to give off the same glow. From the main control room, she heard more shouts.
Malfunction with energy unit! Magnetron number 3 is burnt out!
Backup unit is in operation. All systems go. Checkpoint 1 reached. Resuming transmission.
Yeah heard a fluttering noise. Through the mist, she could see shadows lift out of the woods below the peak and spiral into the dark sky. She hadn't realized so many birds could be roused from the woods in deep winter. Then she saw a terrifying scene. One flock of birds flew into the region of air the antenna pointed at, and against the background of the faintly glowing cloud, the birds dropped out of the sky. The process continued for about 15 minutes. Then the red light on the antenna went out, and the itch on her skin disappeared. From the main control room, the confusing murmur of orders and responses resumed, even as the loud male voice continued.
Transmission 147 of Red Coast completed. Transmission system shutting down. Red Coast now entering monitoring state. System control is hereby transferred to the monitoring department. Please upload checkpoint data.
All units should fill out transmission diaries. All unit heads should attend the post-transmission meeting in the debriefing room. We're done.
All was silent except for the howl of the wind against the antenna. Yeah watched as the remaining birds in the flock gradually settled back into the forest. She stared at the antenna and thought it looked like an enormous hand stretched open toward the sky, possessing an ethereal strength. As she surveyed the night sky, she did not see any target that she thought might be serial number BN20197F. Beyond the wisps of clouds, all she could see were the stars of a cold night in 1969.
Part 2. Three Body. 4. The Frontiers of Science. 40-plus years later, Wang Miao thought the four people who came to find him made a rather odd combination. Two cops and two men in military uniforms. If the latter two were armed police, that would be somewhat understandable, but they were actually PLA officers. As soon as Wang saw the cops, he felt annoyed. The younger one was all right. At least he was polite. But the other one, in plain clothes, immediately grated on him. He was thick-set and had a face full of bulging muscles. Wearing a dirty leather jacket, smelling of cigarettes, and speaking in a loud voice, he was exactly the sort of person Wang despised.
Wang Miao?
The way the cop addressed him, by name only, so direct and impolite, made Wang uncomfortable. Adding to the insult, the man lit a cigarette as he addressed him, without even lifting his head to show his face. Before Wang could answer, the man nodded at the younger cop, who showed Wang his badge. Having lit the cigarette, the older cop moved to enter Wang's apartment.
"Please don't smoke in my home,"
Wang said, blocking him.
"Oh, sorry, Professor Wang,"
the young police officer smiled.
"This is Captain Xu Qiang."
He gave Xu a pleading look.
"Fine, we can talk in the hallway,"
Xu said. He took a deep drag. Almost half the cigarette had turned to ashes, and he didn't blow out much smoke. He inclined his head toward the younger police officer.
You ask him, then.
Professor Wong, we want to know if you've had any recent contacts with members of the Frontiers of Science,
the young cop said.
The Frontiers of Science is full of famous scholars and very influential. Why can't I have contact with a legal international academic group?
Look at the way you talk,
Shu said.
Did we say anything about it not being legal? Did we say anything about you not being allowed to contact them?
He finally blew out the lungful of smoke that he had sucked in earlier, right in Wong's face.
All right, then. Please respect my privacy. I don't need to answer your questions.
Your privacy? You're a famous academic. You have a responsibility toward the public welfare.
Shu threw away the butt and took out another cigarette from a flattened pack.
I have the right to not answer. Please leave.
Wong turned around to go back inside.
Wait!
Shu shouted. He waved at the young cop next to him.
Give him the address and phone number. You can come by in the afternoon.
What are you really after?
Wong said, his voice now tinged with anger. The argument brought the neighbors, curious about what was happening, out into the hallway.
Captain Shu, you said he...
The young cop pulled Shu aside and continued speaking to him in hushed, urgent tones. Apparently, Wong wasn't the only one annoyed by his rough manners.
Professor Wong, please don't misunderstand.
One of the army officers, a major, stepped forward.
There's an important meeting this afternoon to which several scholars and specialists are invited. The general sent us to invite you.
I'm busy this afternoon.
We know. The general already spoke with the head of the Nanotechnology Research Center. We can't have this meeting without you. If you can't attend, we'll have to reschedule.
Shu and the young cop said nothing. Both turned and went down the stairs. The two army officers watched them leave and seemed to sigh with relief.
What's wrong with that guy?
The major whispered to the other officer.
He's got quite a record. During a hostage crisis a few years ago, he acted recklessly, without concern for the lives of the hostages. In the end, a family of three all died at the hands of the criminals. Rumor has it that he's also friendly with elements of organized crime, using one gang to fight another. Last year, he used torture to obtain confessions and permanently disabled one of the suspects. That's why he was suspended from duty.
Wong Miao suspected that he was meant to overhear the conversation between the officers. Maybe they intended to show him that they were different from that rude cop, or maybe they wanted to make him curious about their mission.
How can a man like that be part of the Battle Command Center?
The major asked.
The general specifically requested him. I guess he must have some special skills. In any case, his duties are quite restricted. Other than public safety matters, he's not allowed to know much.
Battle Command Center? Wong looked at the two officers, baffled. The car they sent for Wong Miao took him to a large compound in the suburbs. Since the door had only a number and no sign, Wong deduced that this building belonged to the military rather than the police. Wong was surprised by the chaos as he entered the large meeting room. Around him were numerous computers in various states of disarray. They had run out of table space and put a few workstations directly on the floor, where power cords and networking wires formed a tangled mess. Instead of being installed in racks, a bunch of routers were left haphazardly on top of the servers. Printer paper was scattered everywhere. A few projector screens stood in various corners of the room, sticking out at odd angles like gypsy tents. A cloud of smoke hovered over the room. Wong Miao wasn't sure if this was the Battle Command Center, but he was sure of one thing. Whatever they were dealing with was too important for them to care about keeping up appearances. The meeting table, formed by pushing several smaller tables together, was piled with documents and odds and ends. The attendees, their clothes wrinkled, looked exhausted. Those wearing ties had all pulled them loose. It seemed as if they had been up all night. A major general named Chung Wei-si presided over the meeting, and half the attendees were military officers. After a few quick introductions, Wong found out that many of the others were police. The rest were academics like him, with a few prominent scientists specializing in basic research in the mix. He also found four foreigners in attendance. Their identities shocked him: a United States Air Force colonel and a British Army colonel, both NATO liaisons, as well as two CIA officers, apparently acting as observers. On the faces of everyone around the table, Wong could read one sentiment: we've done all we can. Let's fucking get it over with already. Wong Miao saw Xu Qiang sitting at the table. In contrast to his rudeness yesterday, Xu greeted Wong as Professor. But the smirk on Xu's face annoyed Wong. He didn't want to sit next to Xu, but he had no choice, as that was the only empty seat. The already thick cloud of cigarette smoke in the room became thicker. As documents were distributed, Xu moved closer to Wong.
Professor Wong, I understand you're researching some kind of new material?
Nanomaterial,
Wong answered.
I've heard of it. That stuff is really strong, right? Do you think it could be used to commit crimes?
As Shu's face was still half smirking, Wong couldn't tell if he was joking.
What do you mean?
I heard that a strand of that stuff could be used to lift up a truck. If criminals steal some and make it into a knife, can't they slice a car in half with one stroke?
There's no need to even make it into a knife. That kind of material can be made into a line as thin as 1/100th of a hair. If you string it across a road, a passing car would be sliced into two halves like cheese. But what can't be used for criminal purposes? Even a dull knife for descaling a fish can.
Xu pulled a document halfway out of the envelope in front of him and shoved it back in again, suddenly losing interest.
You're right. Even a fish can be used to commit a crime. I handled a murder case once. Some bitch cut off her husband's family jewels. You know what she used? A frozen tilapia she got out of the freezer. The spines along the back were like razors.
I'm not interested. Did you ask me to the meeting just to talk about this?
Fish? Nanomaterials? No. Nothing to do with those.
Xu put his mouth next to Wong's ear.
Don't be nice to them. They're prejudiced against us. All they want is to get information out of us, but never tell us anything. Look at me. I've been here for a month, and I still don't know anything. Just like you.
Comrades, General Chung said, let's get started. Of all the combat zones around the globe, this one has become the focal point. We need to update the current situation for all the attending comrades. The unusual term combat zone gave Wong pause. He also noticed that the general did not seem to want to explain in detail the background of what they were dealing with to new people like him. This supported Xu's point. Also, in General Chung's short opening remarks, he used the word comrades twice. Wong looked at the NATO and CIA officers sitting across from him. The general had neglected to add gentlemen.
They're also comrades. Anyway, that's how everyone addresses each other here.
Xu whispered to Wong, pointing at the four foreigners with his cigarette. While he was baffled by how Xu knew what he was thinking, Wong was impressed with his powers of observation.
Deshe, put out your cigarette. There's enough smoke here,
General Chung said as he flipped through some documents. He called Xu Qiang by a nickname, Big Xu. Xu looked around but couldn't find an ashtray. In the end, he dropped the cigarette into a teacup. He raised his hand, and before Chung could even acknowledge him, he spoke loudly.
General, I have a request, which I've made before. I want information parity.
General Chung lifted his head.
There's never been a military operation in which there was information parity. I have to apologize to all the scholars, but we cannot give you any more background.
We are not the same.